Thanks, Ian. Reflection and questioning is the theme of tonight's prom, according to its conductor, David Robertson. He'll be taking the BBC Symphony Orchestra, just coming on stage, as you can hear. He'll be taking them through a programme that begins with The Unanswered Question by Charles Ives, perhaps the best known of all his works. That's followed by Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings, associated with the funerals of American presidents. And then trumpeter Håkon Hardenberger joins the orchestra for a concerto by Bernd Alois Zimmermann, which takes the spiritual Nobody Knows the Trouble I See as its starting point. And that spiritual reappears in the second half of the concert in Sir Michael Tippett's 1941 pacifist oratorio, A Child of Our Time. David Robertson and the BBC Symphony Orchestra are joined by a fine quartet of British and American solo singers and by the 300-strong Proms Youth Choir, making its first ever appearance tonight. We begin with those two purely orchestral pieces by Samuel Barber and first Charles Ives, both American composers. When he wrote his miniature tone poem, The Unanswered Question, in 1906, Ives wanted to tackle what he called the perennial question of existence. And over 6 minutes or so, strings, four flutes, and a questing trumpet pose that everlasting inquiry seven times in a five-note sequence that ultimately offers no answer. Ives gave the piece the subtitle, A Contemplation of a Serious Matter, to contrast with its companion, Central Park in the Dark, which he called A Contemplation of Nothing Serious. Tonight, though, the Unanswered Question's companion piece is Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings, a refashioning of the slow movement of his first string quartet for string orchestra. Barber's original inspiration for the work was an image in the writings of the Roman poet Virgil, a stream that grows into a river. And since the Adagio's broadcast premiere in 1938, that ever-flowing water has seemed to hold a different meaning for everyone who follows its course. The piece was played at President Kennedy's funeral, it's featured in films, and was played at the last night of the Proms in 2001, following the dreadful events of what's come to be known as 9/11. While the orchestra is tuning up, and it's going to be some very interesting sounds we're going to be hearing in the first half after this fairly conventional thing. Coming onto the stage here at the Royal Albert Hall in a minute, and here he is now, is the leader of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, Stephen Bryant. And to conduct members of the orchestra, first in The Unanswered Question by Charles Ives and then Adagio for Strings by Samuel Barber, we welcome the principal guest conductor of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, David Robertson.
Thank you.
its tender emotionalism goes to the heart because it springs from the heart. If it is a tearjerker, it's not a Hollywood tearjerker. The words of critic and musicologist, the late Professor Wilfred Mellers, describing his response to Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings, played by the strings of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, led by Stephen Bryant, and conducted by the orchestra's principal guest conductor, David Robertson. And before the Barber, the prom began with the unanswered question by Charles Ives. Well, the unanswered question for many in the hall was, where was the solo trumpeter John Holland? Well, he's now on stage taking a bow, but he was then placed high above the audience, invisible in the gallery. And the four flautists spread out in fine formation in the choir stalls were Michael Cox, Tomoka Mukai, Alex Jakeman and Nikki Smedley. This is David Robertson's final concert in his role as principal guest conductor of the BBC Symphony Orchestra. The orchestra said a fond farewell to him at the general rehearsal today, giving him a large framed photo of him conducting them at the proms, and they all signed it. We're now moving on to the final piece in the first half of tonight's prom. It's a trumpet concerto that expresses its composer's lifelong fascination with jazz. Bernd Alois Zimmermann's Nobody Knows the Trouble I See not only features elements of that subversive music in the sound, but actually adds five saxophones, three jazz trumpets, a jazz trombone, Hammond organ, piano, guitar and jazz kit to a small chamber orchestra. Zimmermann, who was born in Germany in 1918 and died in 1970, has been called single-minded in his pessimism, a composer whose music looks into some of the blackest places of the human imagination. But he's more interesting than that. 7 years older than Boulez, 10 years older than Stockhausen, Zimmermann didn't, like those two intensely progressive composers, turn his back entirely on the past. He longed above all to unite music of the past, present and future in one entity, which is perhaps where his love of jazz comes in. He was quite literally a child of the jazz age, even if he did grow up in Cologne rather than Chicago. Zimmermann's concerto, written in 1954, is a single movement in which the melody of the African-American spiritual Nobody Knows the Trouble I See coexists with the 12-tone technique of serialism. Tonight's soloist in the concerto, trumpeter Håkan Hardenberger, is a tireless champion of the piece. He gave its UK premiere at the 1993 proms. Here's what he has to say about the sound world you're about to enter.
To me, there's two separate atmospheres, something that is very abstract and something that is more concrete. And of course, it's an ambitious sound world. He had the ambition to combine things that one would have thought not to be combinable. It was all an anti-racist statement, in fact. And to combine the choral prelude with 12-tone technique and then this jazz element and an Negro spiritual. I think he is inventing postmodernism in the midst of modernism. He's way ahead of his time. And it's not postmodernism by speculation. It's coming from inside. It's very beautiful. The trumpet part is very, very taxing. It's so compact what goes on in these, 16 minutes. There's hardly a rest. And I think he knows exactly what he's doing. He's putting the soloist through a real fight, a struggle, and then putting this tune in the most embarrassing tessitura you possibly can imagine at the end. Nobody knows the trouble I see. And it just emphasizes the emotion very much.
Håkan Hardenberger. Well, listening to the rehearsal this afternoon, it's very easy to imagine this piece creating a bit of a storm in a dark and smoky club, rather a long way from the gilt plush of the Royal Albert Hall, because the mingling of conventional sounds with the immediacy of jazz instruments really is an incredible marriage of avant-garde and bebop. Well, now the members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra and their friends from the jazz world are seated, tuned and ready. So to perform Bernd Alois Zimmermann's trumpet concerto, Nobody Knows the Trouble I See, the Royal Albert Hall audience now welcomes conductor David Robertson and trumpeter Håkan Hardenberger.
Thank you. Thank you.
Orkan Hardenberger was the soloist in that performance of Zimmermann's Trumpet Concerto, Nobody Knows the Trouble I See, with the BBC Symphony Orchestra conducted by David Robertson. The lineup of the band on the stage, including for that piece, five saxophones, three jazz trumpets, jazz trombone, hammered organ playing just two notes, but several times, quite a virtuoso role really, piano, guitar, and jazz percussion effects. Well, Swedish trumpeter Hardenberger, he needs no puff from me. He's one of the best-known trumpeters in the world. His recent recordings include works by Turnage, Gruber, Eötvös, as well as special arrangements of his favourite film music. He's really into all sorts of music outside the classical canon. Tonight, he's looking pretty cool in a narrow-jacketed silk, very dark but not black, long coat. He's coming back on stage to cheers and applause from the band. I think they really enjoyed sharing that piece with him. He's got a trap tray, a little music stand by his side with a choice of mutes. So that's how you heard all those colours in the piece. He's a professor at Malmö Conservatory in Sweden and, oh, lucky students, at the Royal Northern College of Music in Manchester. Zimmermann is chiefly remembered for his opera Die Soldaten and his last work, Requiem for a Young Poet, set words by Joyce, Hitler, Camus, Marx, and despite its essential humanism, Zimmermann's innate pessimism that I referred to before overwhelmed him, and he took his own life a year after its first performance. And now, 50 or so years after its first performance, the first performance of this concerto, there's really rave reception from the audience, all the jazzers standing, and now the main orchestra. Well, we're live on BBC Radio 3. As you know, it's home of the Proms. Go to the Proms website for programme notes, details of future Proms, and to listen again to recent Proms that you may possibly, unforgivably, have missed. And you can enjoy the interval features. And talking of which, that concerto took its title from an old spiritual, Nobody Knows the Trouble I See. After the interval, the final work in tonight's Prom is a piece by Michael Tippett, which has the comfort of five of these simple devotional songs at its core. In anticipation of A Child of Our Time, our interval feature here on BBC Radio 3 tells the story of a young Jewish man whose fate is at the heart of Tippett's oratorio. In November 1938, the actions of 17-year-old Herschel Grünspan gave the Nazi government an excuse for the horrifying pogrom that became known as Kristallnacht. The contributors are Ron Royson, Gerald Schwab, John Najem and David Cesarani, and they tell the story of Herschel Grünspan, the forgotten assassin.
Grünspan was enraged by the treatment of the Polish Jews who'd been pushed out of Germany. This was the culmination of years of anti-Jewish persecution, and Grünspan snapped.
He walked into a gun shop, bought a pistol.
He marched into the German embassy in Paris, where he was living.
Asked for an official.
And was directed to Ernst von Rath.
Who was actually a very minor secretary in the embassy.
Then he pumped out 5 bullets. I think a couple of them struck Von Rath. I guess Greenspan wasn't a terribly good shot. And Von Rath fell to the floor, and Greenspan sat down and waited for the police to come and get him.
Statement made by Herschel Greenspan to French police, November 8th, 1938. Being a Jew is not a crime. I'm not a dog. I have a right to live, and the Jewish people have a right to exist on this earth. Wherever I've been chased like an animal.
So who was Herschel Greenspan? Herschel Greenspan was a young Polish Jew who'd grown up in Germany. His parents had emigrated from Poland to Germany.
They had lived in Hanover since 1911. Herschel was born in March of 1921, and the father was a tailor, ran a small tailor shop. But, of course, after the Nazis gained power in Germany, the situation of Jews and Jewish merchants worsened and worsened.
He had left Germany to find work in France, but in France he found a situation that was not much better for foreign Jews, for refugees, for stateless persons.
He had to sneak into France. He didn't have proper leave to do so, and he was living with his uncle and aunt. I don't think he could find work. He was a little shiftless, I think, and then midsummer 38, he was ordered to leave France. He ended up eluding the order to leave and living in a vacant garret room until the fateful events of October and November.
After the Polish government had announced that it was going to render the thousands of Polish Jews resident in Germany stateless, the German government decided to preempt this action by expelling the Polish Jews back into Poland. Orders were issued to the police, and on the 27th of October 1938, the roundups began.
The reason that Greenspan killed Von Rath was fairly simple. Here was a 17-year-old. His parents, late October of 1938, were arrested, taken out of their home in Hanover, Germany, and basically pushed across the Polish border with the Germans saying, here, these are your people, take care of them. And his sister wrote him a postcard in late October.
You have undoubtedly heard of our great misfortune. I will give you a description of what happened. On Thursday night, there were rumours circulating that all Polish Jews of a certain city had been expelled. However, we refused to believe them. On Thursday night at 9 p.m, a local policeman came to our house and told us we had to go to the police headquarters with our passports. We went just as we were, all together, to the police headquarters. There we found almost our entire neighbourhood already assembled. A police wagon then took us at once to the town hall. Everyone was taken there. We quickly realised that it was the end for us. An expulsion order was thrust into our hands. We had to leave Germany before Saturday, 29th of October. We were not allowed to return to our homes. I begged to be allowed to return home to get at least a few essential things. So I left with a policeman accompanying me, and I packed a valise with the most necessary clothes. That is all I could save. We don't have a cent.
They were then marched across the German border into no man's land. The Polish border police refused to accept them. So for many hours, and in some cases days, Polish Jews were trapped literally in no man's land.
Statement made by Herschel Greenspan to French police. From the moment I read my sister's postcard, I decided to kill a member of the embassy.
Statement issued by Hitler's personal physician, Dr. Karl Brandt, 8th November. The condition of Councillor Von Rath is regarded as serious in view of the wound in his stomach. The excellent surgical and medical treatment given by Professor Baumgarter of Paris allows us to hope for an improvement.
But the wound proved to be fatal. Von Rath died a couple of days later, despite having received the attentions of Hitler's own doctor. And in those 2 days that he was dying, the propaganda machine of the Third Reich, directed by Joseph Goebbels, went into overdrive. They turned this minor embassy functionary, really a bit of a nobody, into a National Socialist hero. And they turned Greenspan into not a single enraged Jew seeking revenge for what had been done to his family, but turned him into the spearhead of the world Jewish conspiracy against the German people, against the Third Reich. And the atmosphere in Germany became absolutely poisonous with this propaganda.
That set up a sort of rhetorical opposition on the part of Jewish organizations and many in the West who wanted to say this was in no way an expression of collective Jewish responsibility and that they basically disowned the act.
Statement by the World Jewish Congress, evening of 10 November 1938. Though the Congress deplores the fatal shooting of an official of the German embassy in Paris by a young Polish Jew of 17, it is obliged to protest energetically against the violent attacks in the German press against the whole of Judaism because of this act, and especially to protest against the reprisals taken against the German Jews after the crime.
The 9th of November was a very significant date in the Nazi calendar. It was the anniversary of the unsuccessful coup attempt, the putsch, launched by Hitler in Munich in 1923. It was an evening that was celebrated with a great deal of alcohol and inflammatory speech-making. Traditionally, Hitler went to Munich. He then gave a speech at the Bürgerbräu Keller, where the putsch had been launched, and then joined other Nazi bigwigs and his cronies for a slap-up dinner. In the middle of this evening, which was freighted with history for the National Socialist movement, the news came that von Rath had died. Now, in actual fact, this was all staged. It was very theatrical because Hitler and Goebbels and the Nazi hierarchy already had the information from Paris earlier that day that von Rath had died of his wounds. They had decided to launch a vengeance operation against the Jews of Germany. On the night of 9th of November then, in the Bürgerbräu Keller, Goebbels comes into the room, whispers in Hitler's ear. Hitler speaks to him quietly, nods, then gets up and leaves, and Goebbels makes a speech.
Ernst von Rath was a good German, a loyal servant of the Reich, working for the good of our people in our embassy in Paris. Shall I tell you what happened to him? He was shot down. Do I need to tell you the race of the dirty swine who perpetrated this foul deed? A Jew. Tonight he lies in a jail in Paris, claiming that he acted on his own, that he had no instigators of this awful deed behind him, but we know better, don't we? Comrades, we cannot allow this attack by international Jewry to go unchallenged. It must be repudiated. Our people must be told. And their answer must be ruthless, forthright, salutary.
This was a signal to the Nazi bigwigs, the party bosses, the Gauleiters, the SA storm battalion leaders, to get their people out on the streets and to wreak havoc on the Jewish population, which is exactly what happened. They rush for the phones, they rush for their cars, and within hours, mayhem broke out across the Third Reich.
I saw little shops smashed. I saw a department store, which was around the corner from us, the goods being thrown out of the window, police, civilian police in uniform, holding the spectators back until everything had been cleared from the warehouse, and then moving back and allowing the public to help themselves to what they fancied.
The events of the 9th, 10th of November in the Third Reich, sometimes called Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass. And we should remember, that is what the Nazis, and many Germans rather sarcastically called it, evoking all the smashed glass from shop windows and the windows of homes that was strewn across the streets of hundreds of German cities. Jewish people refer to it more appropriately as a pogrom. It was a riot.
I remember a woman walking by and saying that her husband had committed suicide by throwing himself from the window. And I still didn't know what it was all about. But then I walked on and I saw synagogues blazing, the contents of the synagogues being burned on the pavement. I saw terror.
The international reaction was immediate and sharp. The anti-Jewish rioting that claimed the lives of 90 Jews over those 2 days of the 9th and 10th of November, which led to about 300 suicides, and we think up to 2,000 deaths in the concentration camps where Jewish men were held for weeks afterwards, that made people around the world understand that the Nazi government was a criminal and a murderous regime, that it would not stop at killing innocent citizens, ordinary people who had done absolutely nothing except to have the wrong religion.
Questioning of Herschel Greenspan following his arrest by a German embassy official. Why did you shoot the embassy secretary?
To avenge persecution by the filthy Germans.
Why did you feel it was your duty to do this?
Because the deported Poles are of my religion.
Are you Jewish?
Yes.
Paris fell in June of 1940, and the French, in an act of notable sovereignty, I guess, decided to take their prisoners and ship them south and try to stay ahead of the advancing German army. At some point, the train of prisoners was strafed by German fighter planes, and Greenspan was actually free and running southward. He apparently applied to be admitted at a prison in Toulouse, and then later he was accepted at Bourges. And at some point after the French surrender, the Germans asked for the transfer of Greenspan to German hands, and they got it. I mean, the French were hardly in a position to object.
It was a major trial was planned. They built a new courtroom in Berlin. They invited a large number of media persons from Europe, from neutral states. Goebbels, Minister of Propaganda, took a personal hand in this. Hitler was kept up to date, and Herschel Greenspan then was going to testify. If I am to testify, I will say that I killed von Rad because he made homosexual advances to me.
Josef Goebbels. Diary entry, January 1942. Greenspan has invented the insolent argument that he had a homosexual relationship with von Rott. That is, of course, a shameless lie. However, it is thought out very cleverly and would, if brought out over the course of a public trial, certainly become the main argument of enemy propaganda.
Greenspan, before the war, wanted to say this was a political act because I want to draw attention to the, you know, the rotten treatment of Jews in Germany and get the world's conscience rallied to their defense. But interestingly, later on, when he transferred to the Germans after France fell, he embraced that defense.
And it was eminently successful. Hitler decided and Goebbels decided that they had to postpone the trial. In the meantime, Herschel Greenspan was sent to a concentration camp. Now, keep in mind that Herschel Greenspan received probably pretty good treatment because they didn't want this prisoner being held for Hitler's decision. They didn't want him to die prematurely. And so he was allowed to keep his hair, which is a major factor. He was allowed to work in the soup kitchen, which meant he had enough to eat. And was treated pretty, I mean, if you can be treated pretty well in a concentration camp, he was treated well.
What happened to the boy? Well, we don't know. a myth, what I believe is a myth, that he survived the war, that he was living in Paris and had a wife and family, and he worked as a mechanic in a garage, emerged early in the post-war period. But then the idea that he survived actually grew and took more form when some journalists and even one historian, a German historian named Helmut Heiber, wrote a paper saying that he had credible evidence that Greenspan had actually survived. There wasn't any. It was, when you look at what various folks said was the evidence, it seemed to be, well, I knew this guy who said he saw him here, or there was a report by Interpol there that somebody had spotted him, that sort of thing. But nevertheless, the idea seemed to have legs, and it wasn't until 1960 when the Greenspan family asked for a death certificate for their son. At that point, Heiber was then questioned again about what exactly was the basis for his claim. And at that point, he wrote a letter to the court saying, well, you know, this is what I had, and it really wasn't very much. And the German court went ahead and issued a death certificate dated to the time of the court proceedings.
He was in Sachsenhausen concentration camp, and then was sent to Magdeburg, which was not a concentration camp, but a prison. And according to the few witnesses, the people we have, there's certainly, I have never found out exactly when it was, but probably at the end of 1944, beginning of 1945, they obviously decided that Hitler wasn't going to give the word anymore, and he was executed. The evidence that we have to that effect was a document listing the people executed on that particular date at Magdeburg Penitentiary. And it lists the people by their religious affiliation, and they all were Christians except one who was Mosaic. His name was, according to this document, Rudolf Schneider. Schneider, of course, the German word for tailor, which is what Herschel Greenspan was. And the date of birth was identical. So everybody, or most people, seemed to believe that that particular individual actually was Herschel Greenspan.
Testimony of Marcus Greenspan, Herschel's brother, at the trial of Adolf Eichmann, 1963.
I was in the Russian army. At the end of the war, I found my parents in Astrakhan, in Russia. They had been there all the time. I got back to Poland, and immediately my task was to look for Herschel. I wrote to all the agencies that looked for missing relatives, and I received negative replies. I met in Paris afterwards. I went to Paris, and there I met his lawyer, Frankel, Dr. Frankel.
May I, Mr. Greenspan, I do not wish to overburden the court with too much detail. My question was, did you succeed in finding any indication, any clue?
Nothing. Nothing. I kept on looking. To this day, to this day. To this day, I have found nothing.
Within the Jewish world, Greenspan is a much remembered figure. Someone who's remembered ambivalently. Someone who struck back, but who as a result had triggered a ghastly series of events that claimed the lives of thousands of Jewish people.
Germans focused so much rhetorical energy on using Greenspan as an argument for the existence of a world Jewish conspiracy that Jews quite naturally took up the opposing position that this had nothing to do with any Jewish organization or any Jewish sentiment or whatever. So that Greenspan was viewed as, as kind of a freak event. And the less said about the Greenspan case, the better. And in a way, that disposition stuck. It stuck even until after the war. So this certainly interesting and certainly fateful event and series of events didn't get the historical attention and perhaps even recognition that it should have. And I wonder if Mr. Tippett's oratorio isn't in some way a bit of a down payment on that.
That was Herschel Greenspan, The Forgotten Assassin. The contributors were Ron Royson, Gerald Schwab, John Najem, and David Cesarani. Several readings were taken from Kristallnacht, Unleashing the Holocaust, by Anthony Reed and David Fisher. And the readers were Susie Riddell, Patrick Brennan, and Joe Sims. The producer was Emma Harding. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Catherine Bott, for the second half of tonight's Prom, live on BBC Radio 3. There's just one work, Sir Michael Tippett's oratorio, A Child of Our Time, which had as its catalyst the events we heard about in the interval feature. The members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra are just starting to gather on stage, and they'll shortly be joined by a quartet of American and British solo singers, and already on the stage is a large chorus. Oh, I forgot to mention the conductor, but you knew David Robertson was going to be here. This large chorus is not just any chorus. I'm very excited to introduce them to you. You're about to hear the debut of the 300 voices of the Proms Youth Choir, assembled especially for tonight, but destined to appear at the Proms for the next 4 years. The singers are aged between 14 and 24, and they come from five choirs selected from across the UK, as follows. The CBSO Youth Chorus from Birmingham, Key Voices from The Sage in Gateshead, the National Youth Choir of Scotland, Codetta from Derry in Northern Ireland, and the Glenethley Senior Choir from Wales. They were all prepared in advance by their own choir masters. They came together on Sunday with director Simon Halsey for two intensive days of rehearsals and then joined the BBC Symphony Orchestra yesterday for rehearsals in Reading, so they're very well travelled. During this afternoon's rehearsal, two of the young singers told me about the experience of singing at the Proms. Yeon Jones from Glenethwy Senior Choir, and first, Laura Sheeran, who sings with Codetta in Derry. And she told me about how all the choirs had been getting to know each other.
We had a little game in our choir of you have to meet at least two new people every day, or you have to sit in a new section of your section to try and get a more cohesive bond for the project.
So you could back up my view that singing is not only good for your heart and your lungs, it's also good for your social life.
Oh, absolutely. You meet lots of lovely people and from all over the UK, so it's a wonderful opportunity for everyone.
What about singing with an orchestra? Because when choirs rehearse at home, they tend to have a piano and not the full band.
I think it brings everything together, because you rehearse the song at home and you rehearse it with the rest of the choir. When you come into the hall and hear the orchestra play the accompaniment, it's just a fantastic noise.
And it's not just any orchestra.
Laura Sheeran and Yeon Jones, two members of the Proms Youth Choir, talking to me during a rehearsal break. They're so enlivening and heartening to see around the Albert Hall, but I have to say, now in their concert black, they are all sitting like experienced professionals, silent and still, at the back of the stage. Michael Tippett was always keenly aware of social injustice and oppression of all kinds, and came to feel that he must express his solidarity with the deprived and downtrodden through his music. The catalyst for A Child of Our Time was the shooting of a German diplomat by a young Polish Jew, Herschel Grunspan, and the dreadful Kristallnacht that followed. Tippett asked the poet T.S. Eliot if he would write the libretto for a work that would be a public declaration of horror at Nazi oppression. Eliot cautiously agreed, but when he saw Tippett's initial scenario, he suggested that the composer should write his own text, an idea that Tippett followed for the rest of his career. The structure of the piece is based on Handel's Messiah, so it's in three parts. In Tippett's own words, Part 1 deals with the general state of oppression in our time. Part 2 presents the particular story of a young man's attempt to seek justice through violence and the catastrophic consequences. And Part 3 considers the moral to be drawn, if any. The oratorio, composed between 1939 and 41, was written when no one could foresee the outcome of the Second World War, but tonight's conductor, David Robertson, definitely believes Tippett's vision was prescient. Well, joining the BBC Symphony Orchestra and the Proms Youth Choir here in a moment will be the soloists, the ladies both British, the gentlemen American, soprano Sally Matthews, mezzo-soprano Sarah Connolly, tenor Paul Groves and bass baritone Jubilant Sykes, with conductor David Robertson for this Proms performance of Michael Tippett's A Child of Our Time.
were some cast out by authority and tormented, made to suffer for the general wrong. Pogroms in the east, lynching in the west, you're brooding on a war of starvation. And a great cry went up from the people.
Thank you. continual persecution. One race stood for all. Fled from the terror. And among them a boy escaped secretly and was kept in hiding from a great city.
Land. Let us all keep on. Is born in the tension of loneliness. The garden lies beyond the desert.
Outcast. Yeah.
What a powerful and heartfelt plea ending Michael Tippett's oratorio, A Child of Our Time, performed tonight to a rapt audience here in the Royal Albert Hall. The soloists were soprano Sally Matthews, mezzo-soprano Sarah Connolly, tenor Paul Groves, and bass baritone Jubilant Sykes, with the BBC Symphony Orchestra leader Stephen Bryant, and making a wonderful debut, the fresh voices of the BBC Proms Youth Choir, director Simon Halsey. They sang with skill, commitment, and at the end, from memory, on their first Proms outing. The good news is, they'll be back at the Proms next year. At the end of the rehearsal today, Simon Halsey called for a huge round of applause for all five of their individual choral conductors, so I'm going to make sure they get on-air credit now. The CBSO Youth Chorus from Birmingham is conducted by Julian Wilkins. The key voices from The Sage in Gateshead by Matthew Beckingham. The National Youth Choir of Scotland by Christopher Bell. Codetta from Derry in Northern Ireland. Donald Doherty is the man. And Glanethwy Senior Choir from Wales is directed by Kevin Roberts. The performance was conducted by David Robertson, and let's give him the last word on A Child of Our Time. It is, he says, one of the finest moments of illumination in one of the darkest periods of history. And on that note, with Simon Halsey taking the stage to applause from all his choirs, it's time for me, Catherine Bott, to hand you back for the rest of your Radio 3 evening to Ian Skelly in Broadcasting House.
Catherine, thank you very much. Catherine Bott at the Royal Albert Hall for tonight's ecstatic prom. We're back there tomorrow night for an evening of Bach, a performance of Bach's B minor mass, in fact, a monumental work written towards the end of his life, comprising of plenty of music he'd written in the past for various religious occasions. Harry Bickett conducts the soloists, English concert and choir, and the concert will be introduced by Donald MacLeod tomorrow night, who's also to be heard presenting Composer of the Week, as always this week, and the series this week is exploring plenty of Bach's other late music. Tomorrow, just before the prom, you can hear the results of Bach's trip to Potsdam, just 3 years before his death, when he visited Frederick the Great, who effectively challenged Bach to compose a piece for him on the spot, which Bach then did, and when he got home, augmented, too, the piece that became his celebrated musical offering. Composer of the Week tells the story at 6:30 tomorrow evening, and then our visit to the prom tomorrow night is at 7:30, all here on BBC Radio 3. Well, we're going to hear the English concert in action in the next 50 minutes or so, so do stay tuned. Not playing Bach, though, but music by one of his exact contemporaries. Let's hear Bach first, though. This is another liturgical piece which drew heavily on other music Bach had written. It's the Sinfonia, the opening number to his Easter oratorio, parts of which actually began life as a secular cantata, written to celebrate the birthday of the Duke of Saxony-Weissenfels at the time. So perhaps that explains this rather stately opening. I can just see the Duke now riding through the countryside on a heavily caparisoned horse. Thank you. The Sinfonia that opens Bach's Easter Oratorio, BWV 249, played there by the Orchestra of Collegium Vocale, conducted by Philippe Herrewecher. And as I say, plenty more choral music by Bach tomorrow night when we have a complete performance of his B minor mass, live here on BBC Radio 3 from 7:30. Here's a rather marvellous piece of Bach. This is one of his preludes and fugues, originally for organ, but this is a transcription by Liszt, who captures here a very haunting flavour that underpins the music. Hélène Grameau is the pianist. Hélène Grammeau playing the Prelude and Fugue in A minor by Bach, originally BWV 543, a prelude and fugue for organ, but that was the piano version. Having passed through the imagination of Liszt, a very telltale flourish to finish there from Liszt. Well, it's an all Bach prom tomorrow night, and on stage will be the English Concert. Here they are, now, playing music by an exact contemporary of Bach, George Frederick Handel, a very different personality to Bach, who took a very different and much more sparkling course from his rather more comfortable beginnings in Germany, too. Towards the end of Handel's life, he turned out one of his most enduring compositions, all to celebrate a peace treaty in 1748. The king ordered a concert to celebrate the fact in Green Park in London, and he wanted warlike instruments to play it. But Handel had other ideas and softened the impression by insisting on the addition of strings. After all, not only would there be music, there'd also be fireworks, plus the fact it was said to be a very large orchestra on the night. Well, here's a lesser number, but in the form of tomorrow night's proms performers, the English Concert under Trevor Pinnock on this occasion, making, I would say, a more than sufficient noise to accompany all those flashes and bangs in the sky. Thank you. excerpts from the music for the Royal Fireworks by Handel, played there by the English Concert, directed by Trevor Pinnock. And the English Concert will be there on stage at the Proms tomorrow night as part of a full performance of Bach's B minor Mass. Harry Bickett will conduct tomorrow night, and you can hear that performance at 7:30, live on the home of the BBC Proms, BBC Radio 3. Where now, Richard Coles presents the second programme in the series, first broadcast last year, Out in the World, A Global Gay History. In tonight's programme, featuring some explicit descriptions, Richard turns his attention to the impact of Judaism, Christianity and Islam. But he begins on a journey to uncover the very different culture and attitudes of ancient Greece.
Well, we're sitting in a cab, a Greek cab, driving out from Athens, past Thebes, into the glory that was Greece, and some of the great names from classical antiquity, Mount Parnassus, Mount Helicon. Today, surrounded by the rather prosaic stuff of infrastructure, we have power cables, roads, and then up on the mountains themselves, wind turbines turning rather listlessly. But nothing listless about us as we head to Chaeronea, scene of two famous battles in antiquity, and one of them key to our story, in trying to understand something about how the ancient Greeks understood the homoerotic bond. Because it was there that the army of lovers, the Theban band, feared throughout the classical world, met their Waterloo, if I may call it that, at the hands of Alexander the Great and his father Philip of Macedon.
Perish any man who suspects that these men either did or suffered anything that was base.
That, according to the historian Plutarch, was how Philip of Macedon assessed the moral qualities of the sacred band. It was not without precedent. Plato himself, in Symposium, had argued that a fighting unit made up exclusively of male lovers would be both feared and revered.
Who would desert his beloved or fail him in the hour of danger? The veriest coward would become an inspired hero, equal to the bravest at such a time. Love would inspire him.
Does it surprise us that the virtues of virility and gallantry should be attributed to a band of same-sex warrior lovers in ancient Greece? That's one of the questions we'll explore in this second programme in our series looking at global gay history. And if it is a surprise, how much is that down to the rise of the Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, Christianity and Islam, with their shared prohibition of same-sex activity?
Thou shalt not lie with mankind as with womankind. It is an abomination.
Pretty unambiguous stuff, or so it seems, and a view that's prevailed across much of the world and for hundreds of years. Striking then that the ancient Greeks, who were to give so much to the Judeo-Christian tradition, should in this have differed so markedly.
From the Roman period onwards, the Greek custom had been very important, what the Romans called the Greek custom, and what more recent commentators call Greek love.
Professor James Davidson, author of The Greeks and Greek Love, aims to disentangle the complicated ways the rest of us have tried to understand or to condemn sexual practices in ancient Greece. And these have been complicated since at least Roman times.
Because it was so noisily celebrated, not just in Greek literature, but also in Greek art, and because it was in such important authors as Plato, who were widely read, it was never something that was forgotten. But different interpretations were possible. You could have a very innocent interpretation where it was all about Platonic love, and others thought about it as a terrible, unchristian vice.
The whole picture of our study of ancient Greece was transformed, really, in the late 70s by Kenneth Dover, Sir Kenneth Dover. He was actually a stunningly brilliant academic scholar in every respect.
Paul Cartledge, Professor of Greek Culture at Cambridge University, argues that the contribution of Kenneth Dover is profoundly important here.
He started off lexically in terms of what words the Greeks used to describe various aspects of male-male sexual relations. And though he called his book Greek Homosexuality, which of course is a modern term, it's a bastard, it's a combination of Latin and Greek, though he called it Greek homosexuality, what he actually was talking about was what the Greeks called paiderastia. And I'm not sure quite why he used the title homosexuality, because it was inappropriate. But at any rate, he distinguished very sharply between the older partner, who was the active partner, and the Greek word has an active sense. Erastes means somebody who actively desires. And the beloved is in the Greek in the passive voice, so he has something done to him. And in this case, he has arrows directed towards him. And arrows for the Greeks is not just boring old love, but actually passion. Erotics is a very strong term in ancient Greek. That really is where we're coming from. When we study now today ancient Greek homosexuality, we are looking at it through spectacles to some degree planted on our noses by Kenneth Dover in the late 70s.
James Davidson, peering through those spectacles, argues that paiderastia, pederasty, is a system or code that has itself been oversimplified.
There is a popular impression that Greek homosexuality is about dirty old men and young boys. That isn't the impression you get from the sources. It's much more likely to be between someone in their 20s and someone who's 18 or 19, or if it's a case of admiring someone who's 18, 19, and someone who's 15 or 16.
And paiderastia is just one way men related to other men. City-states, island kingdoms, all had their own way of doing things.
There are three different kinds of relationship, if you like. There are these following relationships of admirers from a distance. Then there are one-to-one relationships, which might actually involve pledges, even something which is associated with marriage. And then, of course, there's also sexual relations. So when authors talk about Greek love, they're referring to all three of those kinds of relationship. In Athens, the emphasis was on seduction and stalking, if you like, these gangs of admirers who would follow someone around, sleep in doorways, write their name, write poetry. We see a nice example of that in Plato's Charmides, where the eponymous beauty Charmides, who in fact turns out to be a nasty right-wing politician, but here he is in his youth and he's followed around by gangs of people.
When I saw him coming in, I confess that I was quite astonished at his beauty and stature. All the world seemed to be enamoured of him. Amazement and confusion reigned when he entered, and a troop of lovers followed him. That grown-up men like ourselves should have been affected in this way was not surprising, but I observed that there was the same feeling among the boys. All of them, down to the very least child, turned and looked at him as if he had been a statue.
Other cities, the practices were considered so horrendous. This is, I'm thinking of Elis in particular, in the city of the Olympic Games, which caused other Greeks to worry about it. There was something was wrong with it. It broke too many taboos, I think. Finally, in Thebes, their peculiar characteristic was considered to be formal marriages between people who were close in age and also people who were fighting together. The most famous example of that is the Sacred Band. And other Greeks thought that was very odd, that you had people who were in erotic relationships, in amorous relationships, who were also part of the same contingent of the army.
The Sacred Band of Thebes met its end at Chaeronea in 338 BCE. There I was bound, on the road out of Athens, with John Camp, director of the Agora excavations.
Off to the right, the valley is opening up, which is essentially the superhighway leading into Greece that takes you north and then east of Mount Parnassus. Everywhere else, you have big high mountains, but there's this big broad valley about 3 miles across, which leads you right into southern Greece. And it's not surprising the battle took place at Chaeronea. It's a natural place to try to stop an invading enemy.
That's Parnassus.
Parnassus, well, down ahead.
That's where you want to keep
the Acropolis of Chaeronea, just to the left, coming up now, the rocky one. And the Lion will be another kilometer or so on our left.
About an hour and a half, 2 hours out of Athens, practically in the shade of Mount Parnassus, we've come across this extraordinary monument. It's just by the side of the road. 40 feet high. There's a stone plinth, and on top of it there's this lion that's sitting back on its haunches, muscular, maned, looking out across the battlefield of Chaeronea. Is it right to call this a monument, John?
It is. It's certainly a funerary monument because years ago excavations were carried out down below and 254 skeletons were found within the enclosure around the lion. So it's presumably a funerary marker for a group of fallen warriors.
And it wouldn't be too much to speculate that those fallen warriors were in fact the Theban band.
That is what most people believe. You had 300 men in that band, and there's a group of 254 buried here, and we're told that the band was pretty much annihilated by the Macedonian army, so the numbers seem to work pretty well.
And why should a massacre of just a couple of hundred, 300 men earn such a magnificent monument as this?
Well, those men were regarded as the absolute elite of the Theban army. They were, in effect, the garrison of the city. They were professional soldiers at a time when most of the soldiers were citizen fighters, and they were known for their bravery for the generation or two when they were active.
I suppose one of the things that's most widely discussed with the Theban band is that they were sometimes described as an army of lovers, that they were paired and intimately involved with each other. Is that right?
That's what the ancient sources tell us. Plutarch describes them as 150 pairs of lovers. And philosophically, you can go back to Plato's Symposium to find that the concept that a pair of lovers will fight especially hard.
The lover who is detected in doing any dishonorable act or submitting through cowardice when any dishonor is done to him by another will be more pained at being detected by his beloved than at being seen by his father or by his companions or by anyone else.
Alongside the lion, there's the inevitable museum, John. And this one looks like it's been rather well refurbished.
Yes, it's the regional museum. It has material from all over this part of Greece. And the lion out there marks a grave, and we have here some of the material from that grave.
So this is Theban material?
This is Theban material.
What we're looking at, there's some ceramics. There's a couple of dishes with a handle and then bowls with twin handles. There's some what look like beads of some kind. Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, here obviously some arrowheads, but then also this rather interesting, it looks like a sort of long, narrow, curved spoon with a handle.
That's right. Those are strigils. And they're used by young men in the gymnasium to scrape off the sand and the sweat and the dust and the oil after they had exercised. So they're something that you would find in a young man's kit, the young people who attended the gymnasium on a fairly regular basis. They're not something you'd necessarily carry into battle, so these may have been brought out by their families to inter with the dead.
So would these have been the strigils that belonged to the Theban band, perhaps?
Presumably so.
Yeah, interesting.
Or at least family gifts.
And part of their culture was gymnasium culture. They would go there to prepare themselves, body and soul and spirit, for the duties that were laid on their shoulders, which were significant.
Absolutely. The gymnasium is essential to Greek culture. And, the fact that they did that in the nude is one of the identifying features of the ancient Greeks.
Of such stuff, a great deal of material in our time, which speculates about the eroticism of those cultures, revolves around the gymnasium too, doesn't it?
Very much so.
For a society to make so much fuss about the male body, to produce all that idealism, all that nudity, and then also to have these extraordinary love poems, which are about, well, not just men, of course. There's also Sappho, who's one of the greatest female poets from antiquity. Where else can you talk about the sex lives of people who lived 2,500 years ago?
Professor James Davidson. And if there is a love even more silent than that which dare not speak its name, it's surely the love between women. The status of women in ancient Greek society, just about everywhere in early European history, meant that there's much less on female than male homosexuality in the historical record. Sappho, for example, famously not as other women, is really known only through her poems. Professor Margaret Reynolds.
If we think specifically about the poems of Sappho, one of the most famous of these is a poem that is generally called Fragment 1. It's an ode to Aphrodite, goddess of love. And in it, the speaker, who is Sappho herself, because at one point the goddess addresses her and says, "Who has now wronged you, Sappho?" So her name is actually included in the poem. And she's asking Aphrodite to help her to be reunited with some lover who has left her and that she wants to get back together again with. And the lover is definitely female, because Aphrodite says, even if she is unwilling, and in the Greek, the word unwilling is definitely feminine. So this is a poem by a woman speaker addressed to a woman speaker. The other key poem that makes Sappho into a lesbian, perhaps, is Fragment 31. It begins, "That man seems to me more than the gods." And it is a speaker looking at a man who is sitting beside a girl, and the speaker is clearly in love with the girl.
"It seems to me that man is equal to the gods. That is, whoever sits opposite you and drawing nearer savours as you speak the sweetness of your voice and the thrill of your laugh, which have so stirred the heart in my own breast that whenever I catch sight of you, even if for a moment, then my voice deserts me and my tongue is struck silent. A delicate fire suddenly races underneath my skin. My eyes see nothing, my ears whistle like the whirling of a top, and sweat pours down me, and a trembling creeps over my whole body. I am greener than grass."
How do we know that the speaker is also a woman? Because at one point the speaker says, "I am greener than grass," chlorotera in the Greek. And the chlorotera is feminine. We don't know what greener than grass means, whether she's, you know, sick with desire or young and innocent or afraid. We don't know. But the point is, it's feminine, it's chlorotera. So here is a poem spoken by a woman speaker addressed to a beloved who is female.
"At such times, I seem to be no more than a step away from death."
I think that it's almost impossible for us now, from our point of view, with all the layers of prohibition that surround same-sex relationships, to think ourselves back into the kind of situation that existed for the ancient Greeks. I think that things were so much more open, so much more slippery, so much more unfixed. The fact that you loved, and you might do, a young boy that you're educating in the ways of the world, or in a woman's case, a young woman, was quite separate from the love that you bore to your mother, to your daughter, to your husband. And you could have all these loves side by side. Somebody like Sappho, she's saying to an adolescent girl, this is what it's like to feel desire. This is what might happen to you. In a very frank way, which actually we could all do with now, because it would be hugely helpful for young women in particular, but boys too, approaching adolescence, to know what weird and wonderful things their bodies might start saying to them, which they can't even understand. And I think the Greeks had a framework for allowing those possibilities not to impinge upon or threaten the more grown-up, responsible relationships to your children, to your parents, to your spouses, that had to be held onto at the same time.
"And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, I am the Lord your God. After the doings of the land of Egypt, wherein ye dwelt, shall ye not do. But after the doings of the land of Canaan, whither I bring you, shall ye not do. Neither shall ye walk in their ordinances. Ye shall do my judgments, and keep mine ordinances, to walk therein."
Regime change. But actually, the triumph of monotheistic religion was not one of decisive conquest, but a gradual and layered process which encountered other cultures and their values in a variety of ways. In the Roman Empire, while homoerotic sex was not especially unusual, it wasn't part of the civic structure as it had been in Athens and Thebes. We know of the Emperor Hadrian's love for Antinous by the many monuments he erected to him after his untimely death by drowning.
But as Christianity, with its Jewish heritage, gathered momentum, it brought with it those powerfully prohibitive texts from, for example, the book of Leviticus. Thou shalt not lie with mankind as with womankind. It is abomination. It doesn't seem to allow for much latitude. But Rabbi Mark Solomon, lecturer in the Talmud at Leo Beck College in London, believes this text, written in about the 6th century BCE, around the time of the Babylonian exile, should be read in context.
Very prominent among the theories about why these laws are there in Leviticus is that this was a small desert people, nomadic people in the very early days. Although, of course, by the time Leviticus was really written, that was probably no longer so much the case, who needed to ensure their survival and procreation. A kind of sex that can never give rise to procreation was seen as abominable, as wrong.
It's so interesting how people really, they just, like a magnet, go to that passage in Leviticus.
Dr. Rebecca Alpert of Temple University, rabbi and scholar, is also uneasy about accepting Leviticus's apparent simplicity uncritically.
Nobody knows what the word abomination means in that Levitical passage. The Hebrew word is to'evah, which is the word that we can't translate. I mean, we really don't know what it means. It's probably a bad thing, but abomination is maybe a bit of an overstatement. So this word to'evah was used by the rabbis. They said, well, why should you not have homosexual relations? Because you will go astray because of it. And that's really a play on words with the word to'evah. The word go astray is to'eh atah ba. So they were playing with words, but the meaning was very clear. That is, the prohibition means, this might be very enticing to you, but we want you to have children, so don't do it.
I think that this very, very strict and serious prohibition of homosexual intercourse was yet another way of preserving and enforcing the rigid distinction that I think the Torah wants between men and women in a what I think was probably a deeply patriarchal society where power and most property were in the hands of men. In sexual relations, men are to relate to women in a particular way, the male as the penetrator, the female as the penetrated. And for a male to penetrate another male, and that's very much what the language of those verses seems to imply. A man shall not lie with a male as one lies with a woman. Seems to me to be saying, don't treat another man, sexually speaking, as a woman. There's something inherently horrific to the mind of these writers of Leviticus in the idea of a man being feminized, being reduced, as they probably would have seen it, to womanly status.
Again, the status of women means there's a dearth of material about female same-sex relations in early Judaic writing, although there is later commentary on the subject, according to Rebecca Alpert.
The question gets raised in the Talmud, which likes to ask very arcane questions. Well, can a woman who has had these sexual relationships with another woman, or these misolelet, they were called, rubbing relationships with other women, are they still eligible to marry a priest? It meant, are they still a virgin? That's the first time lesbianism gets mentioned in any way, is can a woman who has had sexual relationships with another woman still be considered a virgin for the purposes of her marriage to a man? And the answer was yes. Again, because penetration was the only criterion for sexuality. So that's the one mention that you find in the early rabbinic period, a little bit after the time of Jesus, of women having sexual relationships with each other in Jewish tradition. It's very, very hard and probably a bad idea to try to imagine that you could take any of those ancient texts literally.
Nevertheless, those texts, Leviticus, for example, demands the death penalty for men who have sex with other men. Their blood is upon them. And the death penalty is still on the statutes of Muslim countries like Iran, Mauritania, Saudi Arabia, and Sudan to this day. Islam, which emerged in the 7th century alongside Judaism and Christianity, seems again to present a contradictory picture of both rigour and latitude in its attitude to lesbian and gay sex. The texts again seem straightforward. This is the Quranic version of the story of Lot in an English translation by Muhammad Asad.
Remember Lot when he said unto his people, "Will you commit abominations such as none in all the world has ever done before you? Verily, with lust you approach men instead of women. Nay, but you are people given to excesses." But his people's only answer was this, "Expel them from your land. Verily, they are folk who make themselves out to be pure." Thereupon we saved him and his household, except his wife, who was among those that stayed behind, the while we rained a rain of destruction upon the others. And behold, what happened in the end to those people lost in sin?
Homosexuality is discussed in the main text of Muslims, and that is the Quran. And also it is elaborated in the prophetic tradition. But it comes under the general concern of Islam with sexuality in general.
Professor Madawi al-Rashid of King's College, London University.
The first mention of homosexuality is Lot, who is an apostle, who tells about the people of Sodom. And those people of Sodom have actually had excesses in all aspects of their life. And one such excess is having sex with men. Yet those sodomites, if you like, are bisexual rather than homosexual. So they have wives, they enjoy sex with their wives, but also they have transgressed in the sense that they have sought pleasures elsewhere that are forbidden. And therefore they are warned. Lot warns them and gives them the opportunity to repent.
Some scholars in the Judeo-Christian tradition have suggested there's an ambiguity about that passage and that the crime is one against hospitality. And it's not clear from the Hebrew quite what that means. Is that an ambiguity that is transmitted into Islamic understanding of the text, or is that much clearer?
It's very clear. Remember, the Book of Muslims is in Arabic, and this Arabic has multiple meanings. But there is a consensus that the people of Sodom were actually practicing pleasures with men without actually using the word homosexuality. It doesn't actually exist as a word in the Quran, but there are references to pleasures with men.
Transgressive sexual pleasures.
Yes, yeah. Obviously. They are condemned, but they are given the opportunity to repent, and therefore they can be forgiven, but they don't, and therefore God punishes them. So this is the level of text that everybody knows, everybody cites.
So as in Judaism and Christianity, the foundational texts seem to offer clarity and rigour, but cultures take up texts in ways that are often ambiguous.
I chatted with my darling, all reserve cast aside, then subdued this reluctant boy, not given to excess. He burst into song, my right arm pillowing his cheek. How often have I sought what cannot be attained? So I shot my love between that kind boy's twin loins, and him my best friend and honoured guest. I woke at dawn cursing drunkenness, though it had been generous to me.
Abu Nuwas is a very famous Arab poet who celebrates his love for young men. But also we find Muslim caliphs in Damascus and Baghdad in the medieval period enjoying the pleasures of the flesh with other men.
And those are presented as people deriving erotic pleasure, not simply as a kind of expression of power and prestige. This is actually about physical pleasure.
It's about seeking pleasures. But at the same time, to seek pleasure in that kind of way is celebrated in poetry, but the person doesn't become a homosexual, in inverted commas. And he may have a wife, he may have children, but at the same time, he enjoys the company